Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough. Welcome back to another Real Conversation with Jim Bianco, one of the best pros in the business who made a call last month, a call, Jim, that I wanted to start with. First, welcome, and thanks for making the time. But I wanted to just actually start with that, because when people make a call on Wall Street, they typically blow it up to just the headline, and they don't actually go into the details of what you actually said. So what I did was, God forbid, I actually read your note, and I got into the risks part, which, again, a month ago in this day and age, it's like a dog's life. But again, everything's moving pretty quickly and fluid. And I don't think you've ever made a call in your entire career where you wouldn't have risk management components or caveats. But can maybe go back to a month ago where you said, hey, look, I don't even know if it was a capitulation or not in terms of, relative to your views of the Fed. But maybe just, start with that and then we'll go from there.
Well, let me start with what you mentioned about with risk components of it as well. My job, I'm a market forecaster. I'm not a money manager. So I talk to money managers all day long. And so part of my job is to pontificate, and part of my job is to help them perform. And what I was trying to say in that call was, look, the Fed is printing money. It is working. Investors are co-investing with the Fed. It is pushing markets higher. Does that end badly? Yeah, maybe someday. Does that create malinvestment and distortions? Absolutely. But it's pushing markets higher. So on the perform part of your job, it's going up. And if it's not going to go up, it's going to be very supportive of the market at least a minimum. And that's what it has been for the last month. As the COVID cases have gotten worse, the market is kind of held together, which I think normally we would have thought it would have sold off. So that's what I was trying to delineate, was this idea that if the Fed is going to continue to print money and push, for a while it's going to work. Now, ultimately, I don't believe it's going to be good for the long term. That's the pontificating part of it. But the performance part of it is that it's going to go up. I'll conclude with this idea that there's this idea George Soros has pushed, that he wants to invest in a bubble. He actively seeks out a bubble, because when you push your money into a bubble, that's how you make a lot of money real fast. Look at what would have happened if you'd been in Tesla the last 2 weeks. Through yesterday's high, you would have been up 80% or so. Now, of course, getting out is a problem, and maybe calling it a bubble means it's going to end badly. I get that, but that's the risk you have to take with it. But the fact of the matter is, if you're going to stand on the sidelines and pretend that it didn't go up 80% in 2 weeks, you've missed an opportunity. So that's part of there's the pontificating part and there's the performance part of it. Maybe you want to call one long-term or short-term, sure, you could do that. But that was kind of what I was trying to delineate last month and or late May when I first started making those noises.
Yeah, and I want to definitely get into the bubble part, because a bubble's not a bubble if it isn't a bubble. I mean, it's taken me a good 20 years to get used to that concept. And again, shorting bubbles on valuation is clearly idiotic from a performance perspective. So, I try to wrap a risk management process around that and not ignore that they exist, because if they didn't exist, we wouldn't call them what they are. But just back on, Jim Bianco's in the bear camp. Like, I've tried to teach people, particularly since COVID, hey, it's not just about stocks. It's not like this Davy day trader thing. There's a bear. If you're in the bear camp for certain, factor exposures in stocks, for example, in the last month, the financials are down 6%, industrials are down 6%, Russell's, on its ass, down 19.5% from February. But if you're along the NASDAQ, it's up 27%. If you're along Tesla, like you said, it's up 80% in 5 days. So when there's that component of it, it's not just the stock market, there's sectors and factors, but there's also the other part, which is, if you're in the bear camp on growth, well, okay, that's one thing. You'd be long treasuries and gold, I think you'd accept. But I mean, if you're bullish on growth, you'd be shorting gold and treasuries, for example. So maybe take kind of all that together. Because I try to get people, not just in some kind of concentrated basket of Tesla stocks, obviously.
Right. You're right on that. I mean, where are we? Keeping in mind that you have to kind of delineate the market from the economy. The economy has definitely shown signs that the recovery is stalling. Now, I'm not saying that it's going back down, but it was recovering nicely. The recovery seems to have flattened out quite a bit. coincident with the uptick in the COVID cases as well, too. Interestingly, we've been doing some work on looking at some of the mobility data. The Dallas Federal Reserve has an interesting index of mobility where they take everybody's mobility data and index it together as one.
Yep.
And there's a high degree of correlation between that or the areas of mobility, whether you're talking about a state or a city, to its COVID case count. In other words, the public seems to, self-shut down themselves. These governors can argue all they want about whether or not they should be rolling back to phase one or phase two or whatever this is. But when the public sees that their city or their state has an increase or a decrease in COVID cases, they seem to react accordingly. And since we've got more COVID cases coming up, the economy seems to be flattening out. So if you're in the growth camp, yeah, there's a problem that you're having with the economy seeming to stall. You're right. That's showing up in things like the small cap stocks. It's showing up in the value stocks. It's showing up a little bit more in the banks, that they have been struggling more. But when you get to the raciness of the Davy Day traders and stuff, and they tend to want to run in the technology space, in the FANG space, in the NASDAQ 100 space, those stocks keep plowing higher. They also have the benefit, too, those NASDAQ 100 FANG names, of also being lumped into the category called stay at home as well. So they've got that benefit going, too. So they're performing not only because they're all running into it, but if you're going to buy a stay at home stock because you think that the recovery's flattening out, well, here's a Facebook and here's a Netflix and here's an Amazon. They happen to fit that category as well, too. So the economy, what it's doing is somewhat consistent with the market. If you peel back, you look at the strugglingness of small cap stocks or value stocks, but everything gets dominated by the headline of five or six big FANG stocks. And that seems to be driving the bus on everything right now.
Yeah. So if you take and again, I think if you go back to the, I don't think anybody in rate of change space would say that from the March, April lows, which ostensibly now we have a full working force of Wall Street proctologists that called that bottom. I think you and I just talked about it in terms of, okay, what does a recession look like? You know, jobless or profitless recovery. There are a lot of fundamental factors away from just the rate of change of Corona or COVID. But COVID, you know, the case count had decelerated all the way up until, and people's, most importantly, their perception of it. I put up a chart on that yesterday. I think it was from Pew or one of the different independent research places that took their polls. But you know, that's actually the first week of June is where people's optimism on the rate of change of case count and COVID being a problem had actually accelerated to its most optimistic point. And that's where the bankruptcy trading accelerated to its most optimistic point. You know, there have been two buckets that you would go buy if you're a Davy Day trader. You go buy Hertz, you know, because it can go from one to two. Or you go buy pizza, I guess that's another bucket. Or you go buy, you know, one of the five stocks that equate to 40% of the NASDAQ. Like, to me, that's what you have to separate right now, which is that other piece. Yeah, when growth's slowing, I buy the growth that I can find, the 40% of the NASDAQ. But, you know, in case count terms, you know, they haven't been buying. If you look at the return on the airline stocks since June the 8th, it's been a disaster.
Yeah, the market is really, it's really stalled at that point. And it's been, in my mind, it's been somewhat surprising it's even held together as much as it has. Yesterday's high, the S&P 500 was basically back to the June 8th peak before it sold off at the last hour of the day. So it's been holding together as this case count keeps falling. And that's going to be, I think, the fits and starts that we're going to have throughout the rest of the year. Because really this economy is really, the economy worldwide is about one story. It's about recovery. Okay, yeah. We had a shutdown. We had a big wave of cases. Now we're recovering. Does that get stalled out because there's a second wave or continuation of the first wave, whatever you want to call it? Is there another wave in the fall or as well too? Because that's going to be a problem, because if you really cut through it, I mean, you know, you could take and look at the case count. And you can look at it two ways. You can be political about it and say, oh, it's Republican governors, it's protests, it's Trump, or whatever you want to say. Or I think you could take a more scientific approach to it and say, look, what they all have in common, the case counts, is indoors. In March and April, when it was cold in the north, everybody's inside and the case count rises. In July, when it's 120 degrees in Arizona, everybody's inside and the case count rises, which suggests that when fall comes in the north, we might see another uptick again. That kind of mentality is going to really, I think, really hold the economy back and start getting people to start thinking about the way that they behave and invest and whether or not we have a recovery to the extent that we hope we will.
Well, because on that, I mean, I think people really love the idea of having Jim Bianco in the camp of like Hyman or somebody who just takes, like I call the secant line and says, well, the bottom is here. I never really called the top, but I know it was the bottom because I call up markets all the time and then I just go at some point in time and I call that a V-shaped recovery. Well, what you just said, at a bare minimum, is a W. And at a maximum, in my world, it's multiple Ws, and they could happen weekly. So, you know.
Right.
So that's the part of it, too, where, like, I sit here and I think about all the other risks. Because, again, we're really focused on one thing, when the reality is that there's the profit cycle, the job cycle, the election cycle, which I know you have thoughts on, too. You know, markets can get quite risky when you're really zooming in on one factor, as you know, and not considering, you know, I look at it fractally, right? I mean, there are multiple dimensions, fractal dimensions and durations and factors to be considering all at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I'll take it one step further that, you know, evolving in my thinking here, I'm getting close to the idea to thinking that the other thing to keep in mind is the case count and the virus count for the economy might be close to the end of the line in terms of its impact on the economy. And what I mean by that, let me be clear what I mean by this, is that you've shut down so much of the economy, you've impaired so many people to whether pay their lease or pay their rent or to get their job back, that even if you had the magic bullet that came through, and the magic bullet would be a vaccine or a cure, that it might not help the economy on the margin. If my restaurant is months in arrears and I've been closed for 3 or 4 months, it's easy to say, yeah, we got a vaccine. I'm not just going to call everybody up and get the band back together in a week and away we go like it never happened. The damage has been done, and it can't be undone by a vaccine. And that might also start to become a story in addition to everything else that we move forward to, is that so many people have been so disruptive. Our lives have changed so much. If we get a vaccine, are we all going to get back on the Long Island Railroad and start commuting back into Manhattan? Or are we going to be saying, no, you know what? I kind of like this work at home thing. Maybe not every day, but maybe, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. And then my employer might say, oh, okay, well, then I guess we only need half the office space that we need in New York City because we've got half of our employees working at home every day. That's not going to be changed because of a vaccine. And so there's going to be some permanent effects of this, even if we do get beyond this COVID thing. And I think largely those permanent effects are going to be a drag on the economy as we start to transition to whatever we were in 2019 in early 20 to whatever the economy is going to be in 21, in 22, and 23, because it will change even if we get a vaccine. And that change will initially mean a drag first, but then it'll be an opportunity after that.
Yeah, vaccine to me, okay, whatever. I don't know. I mean, that's like, to me, it's Occam's razor. It's going, again, finding a simple solution to a complex problem. We can go off on that, but it's also macro tourism at its core. I mean, people react viscerally to this market, not empirically. So when you, again, if we just go back, what you really need is a vaccine for jobs and profits. I mean, so how do you kind of go back to your, because again, I think the one thing, certainly a big thing we have in common is our view of the corporate leverage cycle relative to the corporate profits that, or lack thereof, that are underneath this thing. Like, how does that just go away because the Fed bought a bunch of corporate bonds or ETFs?
No, it doesn't. I mean, you know, the problem with this market is it's overvalued. It really is. By almost every measure, it's overvalued. The debts, there's too much of it right now. Full stop. That really is the problem. But as long, I'll come back to what we talked about earlier, as long as you've got the Fed, you know, pumping and pumping and pumping, at least for now, it will hold the market together. By the way, what ends this, you know, just to kind of jump to the end game, is there's one entity out there that's larger than all of the central banks, and that is the collective of the market itself.
Yeah.
When the market itself has decided that what the central banks are doing is bad, it ends it. It ends it almost immediately. How does the market decide it's bad? Inflation. If you get inflation, if you get malinvestment that leads to inflation, then the market will shut down these central banks, will shut down the Fed quickly. Now, we don't have inflation right now. I suspect it will be a story in 21 or 22. I don't think it'll be a story this year. But I do think that it, with less people working, reducing the supply of stuff we make, and all the stimulus that we're giving everybody, whether we're sending you checks or $600 a week or propping up the market to holding together a wealth effect, stimulating demand, that should push prices higher. Yeah. And we should see some level of inflation. By the way, I'll turn the question around real quick. Let's say I'm wrong. We get no inflation. Between March and August, the federal government and the central bank will either have borrowed or printed 4 years of tax receipts in 5 months. They will, and if they can do that, and all they say, all they produced was jobs, higher markets, no inflation, all pleasure, no pain, then we're full-blown MMT. You could cancel the IRS. We don't need to raise taxes anymore. Congress can send their bill to the Fed. They can print it up, and away we go. Why would, you know, that's why I've, one of my big pushbacks is Jay Powell says, yeah, we're using these tools, and then we're going to put them back on the shelf when the crisis passes. Well, if these tools produce a bad outcome, inflation, you're going to put them on the shelf forever. If these tools produce a positive event, no inflation, good things, they're never going back on the shelf.
Right.
This is going to be the way that it's going to work forever. And I'll give you a nice anecdote I tweeted out yesterday. Takahashi Kurikawa, it's a name you've never heard. He was the Bank of Japan governor in the 1920s and the Ministry of Finance head, like our Treasury Secretary in the 1930s in Japan. And in his era, what he did was he was a man ahead of his time. He was pushing the idea of getting off the gold standard, of cutting interest rates to zero, of having the Bank of Japan finance the deficits of the government. This was in the 20s and 30s. Helped to pull them out of the Great Recession using the same tools we're using today. In 1935, he came to the idea, late 35, that the crisis has passed and it was time to put these tools on the shelf. And he proposed budget cuts and rolling all this stuff back. In February of 1936, he was assassinated. So keep in mind that putting these tools away is going to be a lot harder than people think that they're going to be. It's very difficult to undo this stuff.
Well, it's. I mean, look. I mean, there's Wall Street, and we were talking before this live conversation. We're both at home. We're our clients, people, CIOs, PMs, the people that make decisions. You and I have the very obvious thing in common is that we're not running money, but we're trying to help people run their money with different things in mind. And the reality is that that's a very different world that we live in, Jim. You know, relatively speaking, you said you have your kids from New York, your older kids now, adults at home. It's like the world that we live in relative to the world that what I'll just affectionately call the people, and I mean that quite sincerely, that's a very different thing. I mean, the Pew survey yesterday said, how do you feel in America? 71% of people said that they're angry. There it is. Actually, I don't know if you can see that. 71% said they're angry, 66% that they're fearful, and 17% of them admitted that they might have some pride. I mean, that's people are pissed. And here's another chart from this morning. Like, you saw the CPI numbers. You're a bean counter like me. Food and medical costs, like, they're up 6% in a straight line. Like, if you don't have a job, the only thing worse is having to pay more for your food and to protect the health of your family. I mean, that's why people are pissed off, Jim. Right. So that's like this part of it with the Fed. Like, I think it's shameful what Powell said, or blindly ignore or willfully blind on ignoring that, or just talking plainly like I just did about it. I know that pisses you off, too. But I mean, this isn't just like everything's going to end in a bed of roses for everybody when everybody's pissed off, is it?
No, it's not. And that's why I said, you know, there's to perform and then there's to pontificate. Yeah, I think what the Fed is doing. Let me pontificate now. I think bigger picture, what the Fed has been doing for the last 12 years has been the leading edge of exacerbating the wealth inequality.
Right.
All the Fed is capable of doing at this point is pushing asset prices higher. That's my perform part. Look, I recognize they're going to push them higher. But what they're doing is you're taking the top 10% of the public, which owns 90% of all the assets in this country, and you're helping to help preserve their net worth is what you're doing right now. The other 90%, especially the bottom 40%, we've given them some tools and some ideas, $600 a week extra in their unemployment, a $1,200 stimulus check, that kind of stuff. But what's Congress talking about right now? They're talking about doing away with that.
Right.
Okay, I understand that. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But I think what they should make the announcement is, you want to do away with the $600 a week in extra unemployment, and I think that's not a bad idea. I think maybe August 1st you should tell the Fed that all your programs are done too, as far as supporting the market. You know, let's kind of push it on both sides of the equation all at once. Don't keep pumping the prime and pushing the S&P up and then tell everybody you don't sit on stocks. Well, you're off on your own, because we don't want to have a disincentive to you going back to work. But we're happy to give everybody a disincentive in investing by telling them that there's a floor on the market, that it could never go down because we've got this printing press. Again, what ends this is inflation or something bad. When the market collectively says what you're doing is wrong, it ends. But right now what the market is saying, thank you, Jay, for making it easier for me to make money. That's where the market is right now. It won't be there forever, but it is there now. It has been now for almost 4 months. And I think it's, at least in the short term, going to continue that way.
Well, on inflation, first of all, at least I would consider it, and I rarely will use this number, but 100% mathematical certainty that headline inflation bottomed. You can't get any lower than a negative oil price. And by the way, CPI today was already up to 0.65%. By the time we lap the negative numbers, it's going to be up a lot, you know, on the surface area of it all. But it's underneath that pisses people off. It's that chart that I just showed you. I mean, it's the guy like my dad swinging a hammer, you know, after his shift work, trying to make a living so that I could, you know, play hockey or whatever incremental we wanted to do as a family. You know, he's paying, lumber prices are up 38% in a month. In a month. Like 1 month. But he doesn't get to sell the house for a higher price all the time. You know, so it's like the people are eating it in devalued dollars. And I can't explain that in any other way. This looks like, not like 2011 when Bernanke was outright lying about it. I mean, the dollar was, he got the dollar to a 40-year low. The CRB commodities index at an all-time high. He's like, there's no inflation. He wouldn't even talk about the dollar. But I can see it on Twitter every single day. That's what I love about it, because there's normal people out there. There's some abnormal people, obviously, as well. But there are a lot of people that, you know, that understand the concept. You work for dollars or you don't have a job. And if you do work for dollars, your dollar's being devalued and the cost of living is going up. That's inflation.
It absolutely is inflation. You're right, because the inflation mix has definitely been pushed down to the things that people buy. Like you said, food, medical, those types of things, building materials, like you've mentioned, that you start to see inflation. Also, what's also happened, to kind of go bean counterish a little bit here, they have these baskets of things. They assume you buy X percent of this, Y percent of that, you know, Z percentage of this. But in the pandemic, your purchasing basket has radically changed.
Yeah.
You are buying, you're not spending as much on certain things, and you're buying a lot more of other things, like eating at home. You're buying a lot more from the grocery store, and those prices are going up, but they haven't changed those basket percentages. Now, in fairness to them, it's a little bit hard to do that because of the way that they've got that set up. But this has also been going on as well, too. So the inflation story is definitely out there, and the inflation story might be coming back in some way. And don't forget the other big one, too. If you believe the stories right now, there is a mentality among people in large urban areas that we have to now move to suburban or more rural areas, and there's a bid for houses in suburban or more rural areas. And so now if you've decided we need a lifestyle change because of what's happened, let's move a little further out where it's a little quieter and it's a little more spread out. Those house prices aren't coming down. They're not coming down at all if the stories are correct. So you're feeling a little bit more trapped in your current situation because your house, which might be more urban, is not going to garner the bid that more suburban house is going to get. Yeah. So that mobility that you're hoping for over the long term is going to get going as well, too. And this runs completely counter to what every economist has told us, Keith, for our entire career, right? What kills housing? Unemployment, because if you don't have a job, you're not going to buy a house. Oh, but the last thing we would have expected is, at the moment, we have the highest unemployment rate since the Great Depression, that we actually have this giant bid for houses right now as well, too. So everything is so, I want to say, screwed up, because it's not the way that we expect it to be. It's been very difficult for people to get a handle on it as well, too. And that's not even getting into the concerns about, you know, health and safety because of pandemics and everything else. So, yeah, it's been a very trying time.
Well, on housing, I mean, I think that's just on your point on inequality, and it's very well taken. I mean, it's the mobility of capital. Rich people want to get the hell out of a big city, and they go buy a house. There's a boom town in Westport, Connecticut, and as much as I'm sure there is right where you're sitting. And it was like a 10-year, basically, no bid on homes. And that's... That's one thing. I think what, and people, this is what people have loved about you for a long time, Jimmy. You actually, and when I was on the buy side, that's what I loved about your work, is that you actually spoke English. I mean, so thanks for doing that. I mean, I don't need some PhD wonk discussion at this point in the game. I want to have a real conversation about what's really going on. Like what, guys, slide 74, just to show a slide on what Jim said, because there's so many things that Jim says that are actually, they're empirical facts. Now, if you could put a picture on it and you had to have other people that talk, Jim, have a picture on it, they would look a little off because what they're saying doesn't look like the chart. So, you know, when you look at core, I'm just trying to call out slide 74, guys, that, you know, core, or however you want to define inflation versus expectations of inflation, you know, on the right side. You know, that's consumer inflation expectations. There has never been a wider gap than that. You know, so again, people aren't stupid. They're not as stupid as the economists want us to believe that they are. And I think that that's I think that's just what it is. By the way, slide 75 is the quad three stagflation on food and medical prices. Again, Jim, these are the charts that make people go bananas, or at least get 71% of the people say that they're angry. So that's I think we're on the same page on that point. What do you think on the election? Like, how does this? What I'm saying, like, as you can see, I'm kind of, which I don't like to always do, but I do because I'm a former passionate Canadian hockey player, I guess. I just feel stuff when I talk about this stuff. I think it's okay. But do you think people are feeling something different about the election versus what people would have been buying stocks on 6 months ago?
Yeah, I think that, you know, on the election, I'm going to give you a preface that my remarks are based on that I follow the betting markets, the predicted, the London bookies quite a bit.
Okay.
And as a quick definition, I view them as real-time polls. They just aggregate all the information we know into one probability.
Yeah.
They don't have any special knowledge. So the bottom line is, Trump was doing well until about April, and he has fallen off quite a bit. That's part of the anger. I think people are mad at him. Because what also didn't happen at the same time was Biden didn't really surge. It was Trump fell.
Yeah.
Now, you hear a lot about Trump is 8 to 10 points behind Biden in the national polls. 100% true. But the problem with this is we vote on an electoral college map. We don't vote on a popular election. Biden is going to win California by 25%. He's going to win New York by 25%. He's almost assuredly going to win the popular vote, even if he loses, just like Trump lost the popular vote 4 years ago. So this comes down to about 10 states, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Florida, Arizona, and a couple of other states. It comes down to about those 10 states. Biden's lead in those 10 states is 3 points, not 8 to 10.
Right.
So it wouldn't take much for Trump to bottom out and have a resurgence to really make this a horse race right now. So, yes, Biden is leading. Yes, Trump has been having a terrible 6 weeks, but I don't think he's as far behind as everybody thinks he is. Biden appears to be a placeholder because even with Trump falling off, he can't get above 50%. It's Trump's numbers go down, which makes the gap open, not that Biden's numbers go up. The good news for the Trump administration is that people are not gravitating towards Biden. They're just mad at you. And if they're mad at you, you can make them unmad at you. Yeah. If they think of you as this charismatic person like Obama in 08, it's impossible to overcome something like that. But you can make them unmad at you. Now, he could not execute on that, and that's always a real possibility that he won't be able to, but it's within Trump's ability to kind of come back on this race, even though he's behind. Because remember, this is really only about 10 states is what this is about.
Yeah.
You're in Connecticut, I'm in Illinois. Our states are done. We already know they're going to vote Democrat. There's nothing that's going to change that. We know, you know, places like in the West, from Utah on down, you know, Kansas, they're all going to vote Republican. A lot of the South is going to vote Republican. California is going to vote Democrat. You don't have to spend a penny to pay, polling, or you don't have to spend a penny campaigning in those states. Just have to focus on those 10 states. And it's a lot closer than people are making it out to be in those states. So Trump is behind, but he could definitely come up. And like I said, if I was to lead away, if you were to look at your surveys, your Pew surveys of how people are getting angry and stuff, if you were to track that, it tracks Trump's approval rating very closely.
Right.
Because the president is a proxy for that. Yeah. And that's why, like I said, people got mad at him. But, you know, there's still 4 months to go, and maybe he could find a way to make them unmad at him.
Yeah, a lot of and again, this is why you're so valuable to me in my former seat or the people that you and I talk to every day, because you're making me think about things that I didn't think about. I mean, I clearly don't think a lot about politics, but I mean, the rate of, if I just put what you said in rate of change speak, the rate of change of anger for Trump basically is peaking, and the rate of change of his gap to Biden could start to narrow. That's all you need to know. And you got time and space in between here and there, and that changes the odds at least more so than a consensus might expect, correct?
The betting markets are showing exactly that Trump bottomed out or Biden peaked out somewhere around late June. So it's been about 2 or 3 weeks now, and Trump has been inching back. You know, he bottomed out around 38% chance of winning the election. He's inched back to about a 42% chance of winning the election. Biden is around, you know, 59, 60 or so to win the election. And by the way, quick on that one, if Biden was really 8 to 10 points ahead and he was really at like one of the record gaps to an incumbent president ever recorded, he should be trading 85 to win the election right now. He should not be trading 59 or 60 to win the election. So the betting markets are showing the aggregate of the opinion is, yeah, you know, Biden's ahead, Trump's behind, but it's not as far as you think, and that there is still a chance. At 42% or 40% to win the election, you know, that's not stunning the universe to come back from that and win an election. But you are below 50 and you are behind in this race. Mm-hmm. Trump was 55 to win the election back in February and March. So he has stumbled. So there is no doubt about that. But, you know, the commentary I hear, Charlie Cook of the Cook Report basically has just announced the election's over. Trump has already lost it. He could still lose it, but it's far from being over right now.
Yeah, and that's, you know, for the market and the volatility of the market, most importantly, as it relates to my selfish concerns, that's what I'm thinking here, is that those odds changing. On this topic, too, and just reading his tweets, I mean, yesterday he quite literally, I had to give him a Canadian hockey chirp there when he quite literally, you know, tweeted about the market in all caps being great and jobs being great, the latter being a lie. But the stock market, I mean, the Nasdaq at that point when he tweeted it was quite literally at its an all-time high. Tesla was up 16% on the day. It's kind of like those kind of contrarian intraday OODA loop fades that I look at. But I mean, doesn't he just need that? Is that it? Like, does he think that he needs a stock market to go up? And if it goes up, his probability rises that he doesn't lose.
Yeah, you know, his tweets about the market, the Fed support of the market, all come down to a very specific thing, and that's the wealth effect. Let me be specific on this. You and I and a lot of people watching this podcast think that the market is supposed to reflect the economy, the fundamentals. That's why we hire analysts to tell me the state of the economy, tell me the state of this company, yep, and then I'll compare it to the price to see whether or not it's overvalued or undervalued. That's the way we think it's supposed to work. Trump's tweets, the way the Fed has been reacting by supporting markets, by buying corporate bonds, buying ETFs, they're saying exactly the opposite right now. What they're saying is that if you push the market up, it will create jobs and GDP to support it. So in other words, the economy is supposed to reflect the market, not the market reflect the economy. So when Trump gets all excited that the stock market's making new highs, and that the Fed is in there buying corporate bonds, what he's trying to say is, if you get the market up, it will create jobs, it will create GDP, it will help my election chances. Now, it's not supposed to work that way. And that this is the problem. But everybody thinks, Jay Powell thinks it works that way.
Well, you remember our buddy Larry Kudlow? He used to say, you know, as clear as the sun rising in the east, it's a king dollar and the mother's milk of stocks, which is corporate profits, right? Well, now you have neither. It's definitely not those. I mean, I haven't heard Larry mention either of those two things in a while.
To put it more slowly, what they're saying is the market can never be overvalued, ever.
Ever.
Because whatever level you put the S&P at 4,000, put it at 5,000, put it at 6,000.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, what that'll do is it'll just create more jobs. It will create more GDP to justify that level. That seems to be, why is the Fed putting a floor on the market? Why is the Fed trying to push it up? Why does Trump get so excited? Because they think this will lead to a better economy. It's supposed to reflect the economy. It's not supposed to cause the economy. So yeah, Trump is wrong in that thinking. I think in terms of thinking about the, you know, in all caps, the NASDAQ's making a new high. But to his defense, everybody thinks that way right now. And that's the way that they think. A lot of wealthy people think that way. Yeah, I'd like to take that vacation. I just need the NASDAQ to go up another 1,000 points and we can make, you know, buy that new car and we can take that vacation. You know, that's kind of got this upside down. But that's the whole mentality that's driving everybody right now.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean, by the way, there have been some very successful and grotesque human marketing programs where if you repeat the same lie over and over again, people start to believe it's the truth. So we get that. I don't want to get into that. What I want to ask you a pointed question on this, too. And by the way, if you have questions for Jim, pop them in the queue. We have those being voted on right now. One, do you believe in the plunge protection team? And two, how coordinated do you think this is between not only the Fed and the Treasury, or Pump and Mnuchin, as I affectionately like to call them, and the Fed? I know you have thoughts on that piece, but the buy side. Like, I mean, the things I'm watching at 2 a.m, I've never seen in my life.
Yeah, so two parts of that. Do I believe in the plunge protection team? I'm going to define that. Is there a group in the government somewhere or at the Fed or the Treasury sitting around a bunch of Bloombergs barking out futures orders at 2:30 in the morning or 10 o'clock in the morning to try and support the market? No, I don't believe that that's the case at all. If anything, all right, I'll put my tinfoil hat on for you. The way it's really supposed to work is a lot of central banks around the world do buy U.S. equities. The Swiss National Bank does. The Singapore National Bank, Central Bank does as well, too. Maybe they call them and tell them to buy them. Maybe, but probably not. But is there a plunge protection team that is interested in supporting markets? It's the 11 programs that the Fed has started between buying commercial paper and buying ETFs and buying corporate bonds and buying fallen angels and buying PPP loans and municipal bonds. Yeah, that's exactly what it's supposed to be. As well, too. And in being in conjunction with the Treasury to do all of this, if you want to define that as the plunge protection team, then, yeah, you could definitely define it that way, that there is a plunge protection team. At a minimum, there is an outward government interest in putting a floor on falling markets. We saw that in late March. Yeah. And we saw what the results of that has been.
Yeah, you definitely see it. Like, I mean, it's clearly, to me, it's painting the tape pre-open. I mean, last night, for example, the SPOOs moved 12 handles in 15 minutes on no volume. It's like, oh, you go to bed, the futures are down. You get up, they're up. They're up. And they're always up. And then CNBC picks up on the narrative. Whatever story they need to tell themselves that day, that's why they're up. I'd actually go with Davey Day Trader's explanation more so than them. I mean, because they're up because they're up. That's the answer. Yeah, I don't think you need to.
By letters, as he likes to say. Yeah, yeah.
He's our kind of a guy. Like, I actually kind of like, I mean, I think that you and I wouldn't be accused of not being, like, Main Street type people, like, as human beings. I've just set aside, like, the hyperbole. I think it's more interesting to me than certain people on TV talking about stocks.
He's perfectly fine. You know, and his story is, you know, he keeps referring to the suits. You know, and he keeps
Better take off our jackets.
Yeah, exactly. He's made this into a class argument as well, too. And basically, at the heart of his message is, you don't need an expensive, underperforming active manager to invest your money. You can do it yourself, is really what is the heart of his message.
Yep.
And I think that is really what gets a Wall Street's ire up more than anything else. No. You're supposed to put your money in my hyphy fund. That's the way it works. You're not supposed to trade these stocks on your own for no commission.
Yeah.
And that might be more bothersome, because I've always argued, when people argue to, well, the Davey Day Traders, it's going to end in tears for them. Okay, it very well might. It very well might. But doesn't it end in tears for the active manager for the same reason? You know, it's not going to be that the Dave Portnoy stocks and all the top 10 Robinhood stocks are going to fall apart, but somehow the XYZ mutual fund is going to not be impacted by that. The XYZ mutual fund is going to fall apart with it just as well as everybody else is going to fall apart with it as well too.
Yeah.
And lastly, I'll give you a fun statistic. We've been tracking this now for a while. Since April 1st, if you bought the S&P on the New York Stock Exchange open and sold it on the close since April 1st, it has collectively gone nowhere. It's literally zero gain. If you bought the close and you bought, if you bought the close of the day at the NYSE and then bought the next day's open, in other words, overnight, yes, he's up 570 points overnight. So this has not been a good day trader market to be in because the market doesn't do anything between 9:30 and 4 p.m. It happens at 2 a.m. is when all the action happens. As well in this market. And that's really unusual. I've looked back 30 or 40 years in the data, and we've not really seen a period like this as much where all of the action is occurring overnight as well. I don't have a good explanation for you on that. I've got some theories. But what I do want to say is this has been a difficult day trading market because, you know, unless you're holding them for multi-days, which maybe a lot of people who call themselves day traders are actually doing, but if you're a true day trader, been a very difficult market to be a day trader in because the action doesn't occur during your time slot. It occurs when you're in bed.
Yeah, or where you have any sophistication or tools to execute in the pre-market anyway. That's why the cash has traded, like you said. Last thing that I just want, you just triggered something in my head once again. You know, doesn't it create, and then we'll go to questions, but doesn't it create an ironic, I guess, maybe not so ironic, standoff between, like, if Davey Day Trader stands for the people, and you got the old wall, or affectionately, and the Fed, and your active managers with the fees on the other side. Doesn't it create this interesting and eventual inevitable collision between the two? If this stock market starts going down on the individual guy, then everybody's in bed and at the same time together, and they're all pissed off.
Yeah, exactly. I think it does create that tension between them. So when my friend Ron Insana keeps saying that these day traders, it's going to end badly. Ron, you might be 100% right, but it's going to end badly for everybody is what it's going to end badly for. It's not going to be anybody else. And the other thing I find that's very interesting is when you listen to a lot of the active managers, Bill Miller was on a podcast recently, the Legg Mason manager, and he said that all of these Robinhood traders and the Davy Day traders, he said they're trivial in the market. Well, a lot of these Robinhoods, they sell their order flow to these order execution firms, Citadel being one of the big ones. Citadel came out last week and said that retail orders now are somewhere between 20 and 25% of all of the trading on the New York Stock Exchange. It's a quarter of the trading. That's not insignificant. Now, maybe there's some institutional trading that's larger than that that makes up the other 75%, but 25% is not insignificant in terms of what they're doing for these markets. They matter. They matter at the margin as well, too. So these people that keep wishing or hoping or jealous that they want this retail thing to end in tears, it's first of all, it's important. It's important at the margin. And second of all, if it does, it ends in tears for everybody.
Yeah.
And if Portnoy's message is you can do it without the suit doing it for you, it will create a lot of animosity. It won't end in tears with the expectation of me as Mr. Retail Trader, I will never do that again. I should hand my money to some high fee fund. I'll end with they screwed me and I'm going to get even with them.
Yeah.
And that's the fear that we have with what's going on with this retail market. They're not going to just conclude that they're out of their league. They're going to conclude that somebody did it to them. And then we're going to have real problems on our hands then if that is what happens. So this is somewhat dangerous, what could be happening here in terms of these people wishing that this market would go down and wishing that Portnoy get his comeuppance. Because, again, it hits everybody if that's what happens.
Well, then that's the grinder on the street. That's the American capitalist Portnoy, and I salute him for it. I mean, you know, no offense to Ron Insana, but, you know, it ended in tears for him when he tried it on the buy side at SAC. And, it, you know, there's a lot of people that have institutionally not been able to make money for a long time. And guys, slide four, just look at the flow of it all. I'm showing hedge fund AUM against passive ETFs, ETPs, ETFs fully loaded. You know, the game has changed dramatically, and the game, if you're playing it like a hedge fund manager like I was in the early 2000s, has changed big time. That back, you used Steve Cohen back then, you got big block trading going on, you know, people with big ideas at hedge funds, you know, pushing around stocks, and it was all on fundamental research. I mean, that makes sense, but that game is gonzo. So if you say that prior to this, which is interesting with your number, you know, prior to this, 80% of daily trading, as I'm sure you well know, 90% on some days with the higher volatility, was systematic trading. Quants, again, rules-based trading, not individuals. So if you take a big clip out of that and replace it with people that people are being talked down to as, oh, you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I'd equate like that to like playing in a men's league hockey game in the sixth division where people can't even skate. Like, I could die because I don't know what they're going to do. You know, I don't know. A guy could come up to me and chop out my teeth and then step on my neck with his skates and probably do it by accident. But guess what? I'm dead and he's still playing. You know, so it's an right. Interesting thing. You know, it's you gotta understand that it's dynamic and changing.
You know, and keep in mind, you know, going back to Insana, Portnoy got mad at him. It's a great antidote. Portnoy got mad at him. And he pulled out a Scrabble bag one day and he shook up the letters and he pulled letters out to buy a stock. And he happened to pull out RTX, which is Raytheon, and he bought Raytheon stock. And I tweeted out at the time, I said, look, if he limits himself to three letters or less, he's going to be buying a New York Stock Exchange listed company that meets the qualifications for New York Stock Exchange listing. So why is that any more irresponsible than buying Spiders, which just buys the 500 largest stocks in the S&P? Is it really that much different? And I know that that's really upsetting to a lot of professional managers because it's true. It's really not that much different.
It's true.
You know, and that has become the game that we've been that he is exposing. I still think that the reason he has become so popular and this thing has got the ire of everybody is because it is showing them in a light that they don't want to be showed at. And your last thought for you, you're right, that the game is over for a lot of these guys because in this world, you've got zero commissions. You can buy fractional shares. If you look at the platforms like Robinhood, the Teslas and the Amazons are booming. Well, there's a $3,000 stock in Amazon. Yeah, but you can buy a tenth of a share at $300
if you want to.
Right. And now there's ETFs with zero fees or one or two basis points of fees. So if I've got $3,000 or $5,000, I can buy an ETF that maybe charges one basis point or two basis points of fees for no commission. And if I don't have enough money, I can buy a fractional share of it as well. So the old line high fee open-ended mutual fund and the old line high fee active manager, they're in a secular decline. They're not going to pull out. The only way they could pull out of this is if somehow they could do something that they've never done in their history, and that is actively show that they can beat the S&P 500, which as a group they can't. And so therefore, he is exposing that and asking, why wouldn't you do it this way? Why wouldn't you open an account, buy a handful of stocks you own, a couple of broad-based ETFs for no fees, no commissions, fractional shares if you don't have enough money, and just design it yourself and be done in 5 minutes on your phone as opposed to the old style way. And it's the old style way managers that keep saying, this is going to end badly, this is going to end badly, like Leon Cooperman and stuff like that. Well, yeah, I think this is a different era, and he's just reflective of the era that we're in.
Yeah, 100%. I like Davey Day Trader. I have no ire for that guy. I think he's awesome. And again, if you don't like the game, go play a different game is the way I think about that. Let's just get
you
to
know, one last thought for you, too, on this. Every story I've read, every measure I've seen of all of these day traders is something else, too, to keep in mind. Most of them are actively, not everybody, but most of them are actively betting with money that they can afford to lose.
Right.
They treat it like gambling. So you know what that means? The prudent man rule is out the door. If I've got money, I can't lose. It's like I'm in Vegas, right? You just get drunk and just go crazy and you have a good time. So this money is uber aggressive. So why does Hertz go from 1 to 6? Why are the airlines booming? The cruise ships are booming. Why did Tesla go up 80% in 2 weeks with the Robinhood crowd, you know, kind of plowing 40,000 new accounts a day into it and stuff like that? Because they're betting with money they can't lose. And so therefore, even if they're 20, 25% of the trading in the market, they're so aggressive with their turnover, their influence might even be bigger than that as well too. So I think one of the biggest mistakes professional managers make, maybe because they want it to be this way, is they say, oh no, this is trivial. It might be happening, but it's not very important. It is important. It's not the dominant factor, but it is important. And to dismiss it is to overlook an important aspect of the market today.
I think that's a very good point, and I wish more people made it. Maybe they will. They tend to make your points after you make them, Jim. I've seen that over the history of it all, too. This question is a question I get a lot, and actually, Peter's saying that, you know, both you and I turned into bulls. I mean, to be clear, I'm bullish on gold, treasuries, tech, commodities. I'm not bullish on everything. Bearish on financials and the Russell, but you know, Jim, do you think that fundamentals actually matter for asset pricing anymore? Are you convinced that liquidity is king?
Fundamentals will matter in the long term, and to quote Bernard Baruch, the market could stay irrational longer than you could stay solvent. So ultimately, that's that pontificating versus performance argument as well too. That yes, over the long period of time, the fundamentals will matter. The growth of the economy will matter. The level of inflation will matter. The price to earnings ratio of whatever stock you're buying will matter. But the liquidity is so abundant right now in the market, and it is so powerful in the market right now, that this will take center stage, has for the last 4 months, will over the next short term. But like I said, you know, I don't want to play by standing on the sidelines screaming that's bad that a stock went up 80% in 2 weeks. I want to try and play it is what I want to try and do. So yeah, it does. But don't expect that between now and August 1st or Labor Day to basically kick back in. But ultimately, over time, it will matter.
Okay, good. Jim, you're one of the first to fear COVID-19 and its effect worldwide and on markets, and you should, you know, you deserve a big hat tip, obviously, for that. I'd give you that too. What is your projection on its economic effects from now and the balance of 2020? Is the risk gone?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the thing about COVID as we move forward from here, I'll go back to what I said before. If this is largely understood, if we cut out all the politics about masks and Republican governors and protests, this is an indoor disease. And that basically whenever groups are inside, whether it's hot in the summer or it's cold in the winter, when you're inside is when you see the increases of the disease. And the longer we take to understand that, this isn't going to go away anytime soon. Now, the good news with this disease is that it's not as lethal as we think it is, but it is serious. Just because it's not lethal doesn't mean that we need to dismiss it as being non-serious. That is going to create a continual concern about the economy, the inability to have large gatherings. Look, I'm dying for some sports here. Please start baseball again or something as well. But that's going to be difficult to do in this environment. And as I said before, ultimately what I fear is as we go 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, into this kind of semi-shutdown period where everybody's affecting their behavior based on COVID counts in their areas, and these businesses struggle and struggle and struggle and fall further in arrears and rent payments and lease payments and unemployed people that they haven't called back in 2, 3, 4 months or so, it's going to be hard for these companies to just reboot, even if there is a vaccine. Oh, okay, now there's a vaccine. My restaurant's been closed since March. Call up everybody. Let's get back here and we'll be open by Monday. Doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And so that's going to be a real problem. So, yeah, I definitely think this is an indoor disease. It's going to continue to stay in the South and then, you know, in the fall, move to the North unless we get some kind of silver bullet, either through a cure, a therapeutic or a vaccine. I have no idea whether or not any of those will happen. We'll see. But as that continues, it will continue to drag on the economy. And what I fear, and I fear we might be close to it, we're going to reach a point where even if we get the vaccine, it's not going to matter because these companies will have permanently been altered anyway, and they're not going to be able to come back. And then we're going to be talking about restructuring the economy, even if we get a vaccine. I know Larry Kudlow, I love Larry, but Larry, I understand you want to say that there's going to be a vaccine, and there might be, and then we're going to snap our finger and it's going to be December of 2019 all over again. I don't think we're going back to December 2019, even if we get a vaccine. We're going to go to some different kind of economy. And I want to use the word different. Not bad, but different. There will be some sectors that will lose. There will be some sectors that will gain eventually over time, but it won't be the same. And I don't even think a vaccine can fix that.
All right, that's an interesting contrast to what Kudlow's been saying, that's for sure. I don't think he's well known for his COVID timing at this point, but I said it, you didn't, so don't worry about that. last question, I think this is a good one to end on, because I know what my answer is to this, or what one of my answers is to this question, but I'm really curious as to yours. This is from George in Pennsylvania. What would it take for the Fed and Treasury to lose control of this thing?
I think what would take it is inflation. And what I mean by that is if you were to see a general rise in prices, you know, let's go to Ed Yardeni's famous, you know, bond market vigilante argument. When you get inflation, and by the way, we haven't had it in nearly 30 years to any great degree. We've had episodes of it where certain sectors have gone up, but a general rise in prices. Then the message is to all fixed income investors worldwide, get out now and get out hard. And that would overwhelm the Fed. That would overwhelm all of these policies that they have. Again, I think that's a 21, maybe 22 story coming, not so much this year as well. And as they get out, you see yields rise. You see their inability to control the markets. Keep in mind, the Fed has a 2% inflation target on core inflation. And why is that important? Because the minute we start to see inflation, they're going to start, you know, taking bows. Yes, that's what we want. This is good. This is it. This is what we planned for. Our policy is a success. And then it'll keep going and going and going. And then they'll try and stop it. It'll be too late. There's an analogy for this. In 1989, the last day of 1989, the Nikkei peaked at 39,000. The Japanese stock market index peaked at 39,000. The Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan all said there was way too much speculation in the Japanese stock market in late 1989. So they encouraged policies to rein in the speculation. Their stock market fell 10, 15% in the first quarter of 1990, and they were all out there taking bows. Yes, that's what we want. We want to get rid of this speculation. It's good. It's healthy that the market's going down and stuff. And then they've spent the last 30 years trying to make it stop going down is what's been happening. So be very careful when you get that thing you want, you might get more of it and harder of it than you ever believed. They thought they only had a little bit of speculation in the Japanese market. If we take that out, we'll be okay. Then they realized their whole market was built on speculation. They had the Emperor's Palace worth more that five acres of the Emperor's Palace was worth more than the entire state of California in 1989. Well, there's a lot of speculation in your market. And when you start wringing that speculation out, be very careful because you have a problem. When you start getting inflation, the initial response you'll hear out of the central banks is, this is exactly what we need. And well, we haven't had it in 30 years. And then they'll spend the next decade making it try to go away. It'll be like the 70s all over again at that point, if they're not careful. But first, we got to see whether or not it materializes. And I'll give you my caveat one last time. If I'm wrong, there's going to be no inflation. Well, if you can print up 4 years of tax receipts and just push higher markets higher, give everybody their job back and create no inflation, then why do we need the IRS? Let's just go full MMT and let's just, you know, just go all the way in on this. So either way, this policy the Fed has is either going to have profound consequences because it's going to produce a bad outcome in inflation, or I think it has profound consequences that it produces a good outcome, and then they can never put it back on the shelf. And then they just keep going and going until they get that bad outcome, I think is where this is going to go. You can't stop this. Remember, 12 years ago, Chairman Bernanke said, oh, QE, that's unconventional policy. We're only going to do it for a little while, and then we're going to put that tool away. Here we are 12 years later doing more of it than we've ever done before. They've tried to stop it. We had the taper tantrum. We had the blow up in the fourth quarter of 18. They can't get out. And I think this is what they've got with these policies. The only way out is when the market rejects them. Yeah. And maybe that's coming next year.
Well, you know, I think we can call a spade a spade. I think to Bernanke, you and I would be Davy Day Trader, by the way. There's an ire that's associated with that comment. But I appreciate that you're not like a Fed fanboy and you understand both sides of risks. And that was an awesome answer. And thanks for I thought it was an excellent conversation as well. So thanks for making the time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right. He's Jim Bianco. He was on fire. I love that conversation. It was a real one. That's why we have him. If you want to tune into the next one, we'll be marketing it somewhere on Twitter sometime soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.